headlines, the presidents of Iran and Afghanistan inaugurate a major railway project aimed at expanding trade exchanges between the two neighbors. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman calls on a U.S. federal court to throw out a lawsuit which accuses him of trying to have an ex-intelligence official assassinated. And the United States registers a new daily record of more than 3,000 deaths from COVID-19 in 24 hours. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran and Afghanistan have officially inaugurated the first railway between the two countries during a ceremony attended virtually by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart, Ashraf Ghani. Over 190-kilometer-long Khaf-Herat railway connects Iran's eastern city of Khaf to Afghanistan's western city of Ghorian. It's part of the Iran-Afghan rail corridor and is expected to help boost trade between the two countries and beyond. Rouhani and Ghani hailed the inauguration of the railway, expressing hope that it will help boost the relations between the two countries.
We are witnessing this major inauguration under two presidents' orders and through virtual space. I am sure today will go down in history of the two nations as a historic day.
The completion of such an important project, despite the coronavirus pandemic, is clearly indicative of the two nations' will.
The Afghan president also said the railway will be a key step toward Iran's and Afghanistan's economic developments. The construction of the Khaf-Herat line began in 2007. It's part of a much bigger east-west railway project which will connect China to Europe via Iran and Afghanistan. Our correspondent Juan Avedi says the Iran-Afghanistan railway can have a pivotal role in strengthening ties between the two countries.
Well, this project is a very huge project because it is part of Iran's efforts to expand its rail network. Within the past years, Iran has expanded its rail network in five projects, and right now this is the sixth one. This project, which links Iran to Afghanistan, it stretches for about, when it is completed, it is about 225 kilometers, but right now three first phases of this project is going to be launched. 78 kilometers of this railway is in Iran's territory, and 62 kilometers of the railway, the remaining part, right now is in Afghanistan. But after its full completion, it will be about 225 kilometers. About the significance of this project, I can tell you, it can have a pivotal role in strengthening the ties between the two nations. Every year this railway can have about 6 million tons of goods transported.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the Islamic Republic is ready for the return of the U.S. to the 2015 nuclear deal.
We are ready for the return of the U.S. to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action so that Washington can earn its last privilege. However, the U.S. should implement its commitments in order to earn the privilege of being part of the JCPOA. I'm not saying this is impossible, but the U.S. should not be the one to put forward conditions. I'm not pessimistic about the future. Why? Not because of trusting the U.S., but because of the failure of its maximum pressure campaign.
Zarif said, however, that Iran's missile program is non-negotiable, and conditioning this to the U.S.'s return to the JCPOA is out of question. He described the nuclear agreement as a great achievement for Iran. The top diplomat said the deal eliminated the security threat to Iran and helped end six U.N. Security Council resolutions against the country. U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. President-elect Joe Biden's national security advisor has said the incoming U.S. administration will rejoin the nuclear pact and, quote, force Tehran to comply with the terms of the original agreement. Jake Sullivan said this means lifting sanctions and follow-on negotiation on broader issues. political analyst John Bosnich says the U.S. should first comply with its obligations under the nuclear deal, and then Iran can assess if Washington is a reliable partner to move forward with.
We have to do a little bit of a history lesson here. Iran, as Persia, was an international world power. Iran has now become a relatively benign regional power. There has been no war with Iran since the Americans pushed Iraq into the war with Iran. We have a situation now where Iran has attempted to maintain its sovereignty, which every state has the right to do, to guarantee its compliance with a deal which it signed and attempted to abide by with the United States. It was not Iran which withdrew from the deal with the United States, it was the USA. So the USA first has to undo its error. When it undoes its error, then Iran can make an assessment of whether the United States is a reliable partner to move forward with.
Saudi Arabia's crown prince and de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman has asked a U.S. federal court to drop a lawsuit that accuses him of sending a hit squad to kill a former intelligence official. In the lawsuit, Saad al-Jabri said the assassination attempt took place in Canada, where he fled 3 years ago. Jabari said he was the target because of his ties with bin Salman's rival and former security chief, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. MBS's lawyer said that the suit did not provide evidence of claim. The case was filed under laws which allow foreign nationals to file complaints in the U.S. over alleged human rights abuses. The plaintiff said bin Salman wanted to kill and dismember him in the same way journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in Istanbul in October last year. The Khashoggi murder sparked an international outcry, with the CIA concluding that MBS had ordered the killing. Political commentator John Stepling says killing orders by the Saudi crown prince have multiplied since he became the kingdom's de facto ruler.
It's become almost comical because bin Salman is so out of control, so without a sense of proportion I don't know, his executions have doubled since he became the, as you put it, de facto ruler. He's officially the next in line, but he really conducts all the business and policy of the monarchy. The lawsuit is about a former intelligence agent of the monarchy that fell out of favor. But there was a charm offensive. The New York Times did several puff pieces. Tom Friedman did a well-known puff piece, and none of it has stuck. I mean, bin Salman is simply too dislikable a character, too psychotic, really, certainly sociopathic, for any of these charm offensive and marketing campaigns, the illusion of reform, all of this, none of it is really true.
China says it will impose sanctions on certain U.S. officials for their approach toward Hong Kong. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said Beijing would slap sanctions on American officials who have, quote, performed badly on Hong Kong-related issues. She added their immediate family members would also be affected. She said the Chinese government has also decided to cancel visa exemption treatment for temporary visits to Hong Kong and Macau by U.S. diplomatic passport holders. The spokeswoman further accused Washington of using Hong Kong-related issues to interfere in China's internal affairs. Beijing's decision came in response to U.S. sanctions on Chinese officials this week over the enforcement of new security law in Hong Kong. The United States has reported more than 3,000 coronavirus fatalities, the highest daily death toll since the pandemic began. The Johns Hopkins University data show the number of infections also rose by over 220,000. The United States, being the world's worst-hit country, has so far recorded more than 289,000 deaths and over 15.3 million cases. Elsewhere in the Americas region, Brazil registered more than 800 deaths and over 53,000 cases, its highest number of infections since mid-August. The Latin American nation has more than 6.7 million infections and nearly 179,000 deaths. Several human rights groups have warned that poor countries are set to miss out on COVID-19 vaccines amid a rush by richer nations to hoard them.
The People's Vaccine Alliance, of which Oxfam is a member, have looked at all the vaccine contracts that are on the table across the globe, And we've found that unless urgent action is taken by pharmaceutical corporations and rich country governments, 9 out of 10 people in poor countries are not going to receive a vaccine next year, and possibly for years to come.
The alliance, which also includes Amnesty International and Global Justice Now, said rich countries have bought enough COVID-19 vaccine doses for their populations 3 times over. Campaigners noted that wealthy nations have bought up to 53% of vaccines so far, while they comprise of only 14% of the global population. Rights groups called on governments and pharmaceutical industries to make sure vaccines are available and accessible to all. On Tuesday, the UK became the first Western country to start distributing a COVID-19 vaccine to its population. The French government has defended a controversial bill that aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say.
The French government has defended a controversial bill which aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation. But then that's a direct quote from Emmanuel Macron himself. The rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it will discriminate against and stigmatize French Muslims. Earlier this year, Macron, who was trying to rally support for the bill, said Islam was a religion in crisis globally. Their remarks were widely criticized worldwide and led to anti-France protests. The bill in question says, among other things, that any person or entity in France is obliged to respect the country's principles of secularism. It also calls for more scrutiny over funding of French mosques. And now joining us for this news review is Chris Denhant from Paris and Imad Hamad, Executive Director from American Human Rights Council, the AHRC, joining us out of Michigan. Gentlemen, I would like to welcome you both to the program. We're going to have to start first with our correspondent there in France. Chris, hope you're safe and doing well. Tell us, Chris, why are there so many fears that the French government does more to stoke Islamophobic sentiments than to put it to rest?
Well, this law is considered as not necessary, and it's totally in the line of the, let's say, the preparation of the next presidential elections, because it's a law about what they call separatism, but afterwards the term Islamic separatism has been added, and human rights associations blame the French government for this, because they say it's one community that is being targeted and it's increasing the general atmosphere of Islamophobia after some terrorist attacks, like the beheading of a teacher in France. So they criticize the French government of taking advantage of the COVID crisis in order to impose new liberticide laws, not only on the Islam community, on the Muslim community, but also on the global security law.
Right, Chris, and you're a French citizen there, Chris. How do you see it? What do you see? I mean, Muslims living in France, tell us how you see firsthand their trials and tribulations of trying to incorporate, you know, their devotee to Islam, and at the same time, have, you know, be left alone and live in peace in France.
Well, they don't see why they should be targeted. Meanwhile, you have also in France white suprematist groups who are not targeted at all. You have also pro-Israel groups. You have far-right the Jewish Defense League groups who commit violent acts against pro-Palestinian activists who have been accused and condemned for these acts. Those people are not at all targeted. It's just one-sided. It's a one-sided attack on the Muslim community, which is again a proof of the switch of the Macron government to the right and to the far right in order to prepare his next elections.
Thank you, Chris. And Imad Hamad, I'd like to welcome you to the program here. Your initial thoughts on the story, please.
Well, first of all, we have to be reminded that security and respecting human dignity and human respect for every person, regardless of faith, gender, color, race, is a basic human right that must be respected and must be protected. There's no justification whatsoever for general labeling and general condemnation. It's a very unfortunate situation that we're witnessing such an Islamic increase against people of Muslim faith in France. This is something that Muslims faced in, across Europe and the United States, even among their own countries sometimes. So what's happening in France is very alarming, simply because the effort to introduce such a bill and the president of France remarks open doors wide for you know, racism, hate, and potential acts of violence and hate crimes to take course against people of Muslim faith. Definitely, this is not acceptable. It should not be tolerated under any circumstances. Definitely, we see this as something that does not respect, that does not reflect the French people values, nor the American values, nor the European values, nor the Muslim values. What's bad is bad, what's good is good, and not by the name of those who hijack the noble and respected faith of Islam and commit horrific crimes. That's a reason to for general condemnation and guilt by association approach against the population in France.
It still seems like when I hear reports of Muslims in France, they get a different treatment. It seems like they're living more a part of a you know, segregationist type, apartheid type system in France than other Muslims in other Western, as a, you know, as opposed to American Muslims, Canadian Muslims, or English Muslims. Why?
I think there is an interpretation of the secular law, which is an extremist interpretation. But I don't think we have to exaggerate the treatment of the French Muslims neither. I think the main problem, which is never highlighted in the political scenes or in the mass media, is that the real causes of terrorist attacks, the real causes of Takfirist extremism, are never highlighted in the mass media. So they will never accentuate, they will never inform the public opinion that, for instance, Iran or Hezbollah or the Syrian Kurds, they are fighting against the Islamic State, against Al-Qaeda, against extremist groups financed by Saudi Arabia, by the Emirates, by Qatar, and by Turkey. This kind of distinction will never be made.
Thank you, gentlemen, both. Do stay safe till we speak to both of you again. Kristen Hunt joining us out of Paris, and Imad Hamed, Executive Director of the American Human Rights Council, joining us from Michigan. And that's a wrap for the segment of Europe News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kit Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere that abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. You know, everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so. And everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat-eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and... sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
Also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the
climate change activist against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already, and the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this, as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course, he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots, perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on, as we showed at clips in regard to that part of the program. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming? No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films? And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but he does break it down in quite very obvious terms. He uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under? I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something. And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does You know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on. But I mean, when he talks, he goes through it in detail. There's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. Mm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
Mm-hmm. It is a myth. That's what he suggests in the documentary, which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumerist society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely. And if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction. It's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment? No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and in humane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing, and it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not they'll turn vegan is another matter, but they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet. I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, they say, you know, you use less coal, ride your bike, you know, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. In terms of, yeah, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I was invited to a meeting with Al Gore some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here? Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
but you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organizations, you know. I understand lobbyists, I would expect that from them, and to a certain extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the BT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another, go
what
on, sorry.
What was also interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. So either they keep ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost
the case. He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time. Maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing actually. They have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is putting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they are monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learn from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you've put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject. You know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that the funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But I don't know that. Verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the programme. I mean, he's been criticised for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا ذل كذل الطمع.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "There is no disgrace worse than that of greed."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In these beautiful dialogues which we find regarding Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam in the Ahl al-Bayt, we find that there is a very long but interesting and profound dialogue between one of the students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. So this dialogue is a dialogue between the teacher and the student. In this dialogue, we find that Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, puts forth some very immortal commandments and statements full of quite high moral standards and ideals. And truly, even though this is a simple conversation, but if the standards and ideals are implemented and put into effect, surely a human being can attain the heights of perfection. One of the statements that we find in this conversation between Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is when the Imam says, "Remain wary of Iblis through the tearful fear of Allah. Beware of the false hope, for it throws into the truthful fear. Adorn yourself for Allah, the Great and Almighty, through honesty in your actions, and show love to Allah through the quick change." In this part of this long dialogue, which we have been discussing, we find that first and foremost, Imam Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, says to be careful of shaitan by having fear of Allah. Now here, when we talk about fear of Allah, we mean the fear of disobeying Allah, of breaking Allah's commandments, of making Allah angry at us for being disobedient, and not involuntary disobedience, which sometimes happens, and we can ask forgiveness for that as well, but voluntary disobedience, in-your-face disobedience. We should be fearful of this. We should also be careful of false hopes and long materialistic desires, false hopes in the materialistic world. Oh, one day I'm going to be a bazillionaire. Because Imam al-Baqir says this throws a person into truthful fear when one is careful of their false hopes. Finally, Imam al-Baqir says that we should adorn ourselves, beautify ourselves by having honesty and sincerity in our actions. Very beautiful points to ponder in this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who's going to talk about today's topic.
And so I would like to talk a little bit about the historical conditions that surrounded this great imam and see what lessons we can learn from him and in the struggles that he had to face. And so the imam concentrated his efforts on the intellectual development of the Muslim Ummah. The Muslim Ummah in general and the Shia community in particular. And this is something that I think we could learn from the imams. For example, the idea of coinage was something that the imam had suggested to the Khalif for him to do. Before that, they were using the old coins based upon the old empires, the old Byzantine and Sassanid empires. He was behaving the same way like Imam Ali alayhi salam. Insofar as the knowledge and advice is not something that you restrict to just people who follow you or people who agree with you or people who you like. But knowledge and advice is something that is open for all. It doesn't mean to say that you support them in what they do, but you would be helping them in doing good, in doing that which is best. The imams are teaching us that in a time where the overwhelming power is in the hands, the overwhelming military power and economic power is in the hands of those people who are inimical of truth and justice, that the best thing to do is not necessarily to rise up. You rise up only when you have the right organization, when you have the right strategy, when you have the right politics, when you have the right people who have the right foresight to be able to know what to do. That's when you rise up. In the meantime, what you do is you increase yourself in knowledge. What you do is you impart that knowledge to others. What you do is you offer a helping hand. What you do is you advise others where they ask you for advice. And in this way, you build up a movement which, after a long time in history, its time will come to pass where it will be able to rise up and create a just system. Give salawat to the Holy Prophet Muhammad and his family.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.